join us in a world where you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Sit back as we discuss hard lessons from the best and brightest the personal defense and competition shooting industry has to offer. Let us help you help yourself, no matter where you are on your personal path. Ballistic Radio is brought to you by Centurion Arms, hard-use rifles and accessories at easy day prices. Visit them online at centurionarms.com. Now here's your host, John Johnson.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Centurion Arms, hard-use rifles and accessories at easy day prices. Visit them online at centurionarms.com. I'm your host, John Johnson. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, class announcements, other things at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Hey, Joe.
Class announcements?
Yeah, I do those sometimes.
See that?
That's odd. Very odd. But people seem to enjoy it, and I certainly do. So I'm, anyway. Hey, I'm super excited because joining us on today's show, one of my very favorite people and someone that has helped me out quite a bit, it's Daryl Bulkey. Daryl, how's it going, man?
Good.
So I'm really excited about this one in particular because, as you well know, I am somewhat of a history nerd, and I used to say, you know, I can't really say it anymore because I'm not one of the new guys anymore, which is weird, but it seems that at least for somebody my age, I'm more interested in history than some of my contemporaries, but I actually think that has changed quite a bit. There's been a lot, at least in my group, a lot more interest in the where's and why's and in all that than there was when I was younger. I don't know. I think that was really ugly, and I apologize. I said that's stupid, but hopefully you know what I mean. So
I can lay that actually out for you on how that happens. Tom Gibbons actually had a formula.
We'll talk about that in a second. Before we do, who are you and what do you do? And we'll go from there.
Daryl Bulkey, retired police officer from California. I started in the firearms and equipment industry in 1986, then became a cop, did the cop thing, really heavily involved in the firearms side, whether it was range stuff, shooting stuff, being in shootings, investigating shootings, that type of thing. Was injured in the line of duty and retired, been pretty heavy in the VIP, executive protection, higher-end security contractor stuff, and have a firearms training company in Dallas, Texas, called Hardwire Tactical Shooting that I run with Wayne Dobbs. And then my current thing is I'm actually writing a historical book about the double-action revolver in the 20th century. That's kind of me.
I am so excited for that book to be done. I cannot even tell you. So,
and you know, I'm taking an approach that most have never done. Originally, I was procrastinating because writing a technical book about that was going to take me forever. What I'm going to do is I take guns that are a individual gun and write the historical story of it and its history. So you could literally open any chapter, read it, and it'd be actually interesting reading versus the technical stuff. It's more of the who owned it or what type of person would have owned it and how it would have been used in its historical sense or where it fits in the big picture. And I'm really excited about how it's coming together. It's, you know, it's a lot of work, but it's passion at this point. So,
no, that's going to be very, very cool. So at the beginning of this, you mentioned a formula that Tom Givens has as far as how one's interest in the where and the whys and the hows comes up. And that's something I've always kind of had for my entire life, actually. But I tell me more.
So Tom's made an observation, as Tom does, that, you know, the every 15 years this stuff recycles. You just watch the cycle start. And I it hit me pretty significantly because when he discussed that, I had just hit my 30th year as a firearms instructor. And I looked back and I said, yeah, my first 15 years was building experience, going to classes, and really trying to figure out what worked and what didn't work. And to get myself at a, was wholly devoted to getting myself to a professional level of where I wanted to be. A lot of the competition stuff was in that first 15 years. I was in multiple actual shootings that first 15 years. I was in a job where I was using a firearm every day. I was on the deep dive, took a lot of classes. The second 15 years, you know, you start realizing this is starting to all, you know, you start seeing the stuff coming back again and you go, well, you know, we already did this rodeo. And the second 15 years, I was much more focused on refining my teaching, building a better, deeper understanding of why stuff, and really cleaning out the garbage as I'm watching everybody else cycle through what I just did the first 15 years. Well, what I realized after I hit 30 years, and I've gone insane the last few years on firearms history and, you know, truly investing in a massive investment in investment grade revolvers and doing the research on those guns back into the history and stuff, I found out that like most of this stuff all came from the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
And we have just recycled it over and over and over again. But it all really, that's really sort of the point, was about the, you know, late teens into the 20s. And when I got into that third phase, you start having a completely different look. You've done all the shooting stuff. You've done the teaching stuff. You've done the training stuff. You've done a lot of this. You've done the research. And then you start to really get in, because you're getting old is what it really comes down to. And you start, the interest really gets into where did all of this come from and how does it all fit together? But you have a much better perspective of that. And that's sort of where I've decided my place in the industry should be now, is sort of this historian dude. But if you look at guys like Ken Hackathorn, Tom Gibbons, Pat Rogers, all of these guys were they were all well into their 30s. Yeah, they had been doing this stuff for 45 years. I mean, they were well into the third phase.
Yeah.
And it's a different outlook that is, I can say personally, is completely different. And as you age in this, you build, you know, experience, wisdom, a lot of this stuff. You get frustrated a lot with what you see, because it's like, and you'll hear that probably today when we talk, it's like, no, dude, you didn't invent that. No, dude, that ain't new. If you had actually been around or done some of this, you would figure out that, you know, this is not some miraculous idea that you just hatched up or whatever. And, you know, you start taking a different dive. And I think it becomes, instead of it's all about me, it becomes it's all about, I think the first 15 years is all about me. The second 15 years is sort of all about how can I teach better. And the last, that third phase, is more into the, you know, where did this really come from? How does it develop? How does it cycle? What have we better figured out through history, and where should we be going? And then you try to help others get on that, the younger folks get on that program so that they can continue developing it.
Well, and that's, you know, we don't have a ton of time left in this segment, but I think that, so it's weird at this point for me, because I have been the younger guy that ran his mouth too much and thought he knew everything and really annoyed and frustrated and frankly unintentionally was disrespectful to my betters and elders. And I've been that dude. And, you know, I look back at that and I'm embarrassed by it. And I'm certainly not, you know, I do not have the time in this or the experience in this to say that you know, I have figured out anything great or whatever, but I can at least see like a potential path forward where, you know, higher power willing, I do this the rest of my life. And, you know, I can see that. And I feel very in this weird middle place right now, right? And because I remember being the arrogant jerk, I apologize to everyone who had to put up with me in that. And we
all did it. It's just a question of how long we do it. Some people never realize that, and they spend their entire life in this industry being the same person they started out at, that we kind of all did in that. And, you know, that you know, it's called maturity, experience, tends to breed wisdom, and it's usually bad experience.
Yep.
You get wisdom from screwing up. But the first thing you got to realize is you screwed up.
Yeah.
That's sort of the big revelation is, boy, I was approaching that wrong, or boy, I really messed that up. And that then translates into true wisdom, but a lot of people, you know, again, their egos and sort of how society works, especially these days with social media, really can't get on board the self-analysis of, boy, did I screw up.
Right.
And, you know, it's not conducive to sort of how we do things these days of that self-awareness and realization or understanding mistakes and stuff. But yeah, that's life. It's a process.
Yeah. Well, and what I was going to say, and then we have to go to break, is that, so there's this weird thing that I see, at least in this middle spot that I'm occupying right now, to where the younger side of things looks at people that really know, have this lifetime of amazing experience and knowledge and history, and they see an old guy yelling at clouds. Like, yeah, okay, boomer. And I'm not, I would never say that. That's not, I don't think that way.
I really
don't.
At some point.
maybe in the past, but like right now.
Right, that's what I mean. No, in the past you probably were like, what are these graybeards talking about?
Right. And then the flip side of that is, and I think this is a danger as well, is that, you know, the younger generation's passion and almost bullheadedness is part of the thing that drives innovation. And kind of one of the things that I would like to do with this episode is sort of talk about that and see where it meets in the middle, or if it does meet in the middle. But we do have
to go. It does.
Yeah, we do have to go to break. Right now we're talking with Daryl Bulkey. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Centurion Arms, hard use rifles and accessories at easy day prices. Visit them online at centurionarms.com. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 911s and scatterguns since 1977, a legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the EDC X9 series of guns, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match grade accuracy, superior ergonomics and concealability, with modern service pistol capacity as well as reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. So we're talking with Daryl Bulkey about, well, all sorts of things. Kind of, we're going to get into some history. Then we're going to get into some, I guess, dynamics of how information is passed along and evolves. And one of the things that I was saying before the break that I'd really love to hear what you have to say about it is kind of where does that middle ground happen between these vast, vast wealth of knowledge and a lifetime of experience that are all unique and frankly irreplaceable, but the jadedness that oftentimes comes along with that versus the bullheadedness and like passion with the people that are like starting out. Like, how does that all play into this?
Well, you know, so usually what happens is, you know, kind of historically, is you will have what I sort of call the professional gun carriers, whether they're law, and it's usually law enforcement. It's always a good place to look, and it's just because of the amount of frequency and interaction and violence that occurs in that world, and particularly in different places. So, you know, when I said earlier, for example, that a lot of this started coming out in the late teens and 20s, well, if you look at what was happening in the teens and 20s, we were moving into a new technological society that was vehicle-based rather than horse-based, which changed a lot of the gear from horse-based carry to pedestrian city and true metropolitan city-based carry and vehicle-borne carry systems, be that trains or automobiles. So all of that was sort of becoming new and changing stuff. Style of clothes were changing. The way people lived was significantly changing in the 20s, as far as like things like we don't really think about, but like refrigerators, radios, electricity and running and plumbing.
Yeah.
That was not just for the elite, but normal people were beginning to have these things. And with that, you know, a lot I credit to, you know, Fitzgerald, who, you know, you put a picture of a Fitz revolver up these days with the front of the trigger guard cut out of the revolver.
Yeah, we did an episode on that.
Right, and every new Glock person just loses their mind. Well, it was a different world, and what Fitz did was he was sort of, you know, everybody gets on the, oh, my God, Craig Douglas and ECQC. I've been friends with Craig for two decades. And, you know, you sit there and go, Fitz originated that. Part of the reason the trigger guard was cut was if on a gun takeaway, you don't break your finger. You know, and how to get the gun deployed while entangled in urban robbery scenarios. You know, you're sitting here going, this was where all this, you know, sort of came from. That was very innovative at the time. And you had people who thought it was all stupid and people who thought it was great back then. You know, like we have now where we argue and fight over stuff. I've posted pictures of holsters for double action revolvers with exposed triggers. And again, my box lights up with or comments of people, well, I'm a certified concealed carry instructor, and that is unsafe. You know, you can pull that trigger on a well-constructed holster, on a properly built one. You know, that's always the other problem is crap gear versus good gear. On a well-built holster with an exposed trigger guard, on a double action revolver, you can pull that pull the trigger. The cylinder doesn't turn in there, so the gun can't go off, even though the trigger guard's exposed. Now, take that same gun, put it into a modern striker gun, and particularly some of the newer ones with the pre-cocked actions.
Yeah.
Do you really want that trigger guard exposed? Absolutely not, because you just look at it funny, and it's going to go off inside the holster. Again, it's understanding why, but without a trigger guard being covered in leather, the profile of the holster is much smaller for concealment reasons.
Yep.
And you were looking at how we trained back then. We trained to put a finger on the trigger right on the draw. It wasn't applying pressure. It was lightly rested. And with the double action triggers of a lot of these guns, you know, you're talking 12-plus pounds and a lot of movement, and particularly on stuff like a Colt New Service or a Smith & Wesson N-Frame, you're turning a whole lot of cylinder with your finger before it will remotely go off. I'm not saying you can't have a negligent discharge, but it sure takes a lot more to do it than many of the modern trigger systems. So again, if you kind of look at this, but we go back to stuff and you're seeing right now, and I mean, I don't need to explain this to you. We are truly, for example, right now in the golden age of the double action, single action semi-auto, or even going back to the double action only semi-autos. I believe you got a D something or other these days, right?
Well, I did.
Or playing with one.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
It never worked for me, but I understood. But it was one of those things where I looked at almost like how I look at the HKLM right now.
Yeah.
Is, boy, if I was equipping a police department of 1,200 people who don't want to shoot or do anything training and no firearm stuff, for managing people, I kind of like that idea.
Well, so what's funny for
me. You
know
what I mean?
Oh, I do. And what's funny, so I learned to shoot on a Smith & Wesson Model 19. That was the first handgun I ever shot. I started with rifles when I was 4. I don't think I started shooting handguns until I was 6 or so. But, like,
yeah.
for a very long time, my experience was that. And that is an unusual experience for most people my age, I feel like, in having
right.
in having talked with them. So, but as far as, like, I loved the... Ernest Langdon built me an incredibly nice LTT 92D, and it was perfect, except for he didn't have a way to get a dot on it at the time. And unfortunately, that is a requirement for me because of the stupid human trick kind of shooting that I like to do. And it is a stupid human trick.
We can talk about that too, but you know, the whole thing with that is, if you think about it, if the only experience you had was with that Model 19, which was a lot of people's life, well, then that 92D, all of a sudden, that would have been a really good transition if your trigger finger didn't like to do something different
right.
on how you press it. But again, if you think about most of what we're doing with law enforcement today, you know, with those kind of triggers, you get much more deliberate work. You get much less, we didn't have a lot of the problems with negligent discharges they have today, even though they're violating, finger on the trigger, stuff. And there's multiple ways to pull that trigger without your brain involved. That 12 pounds and that length and distance did prevent a lot of mistakes from happening with the, and where we could, you could almost guarantee an ND in law enforcement in the revolver days is if they were cocked.
Yeah.
You could just about guarantee them. When I trace back a lot of them, at my own agency, they were all cocked guns.
Yeah.
And you sit there and go, oh, well, they made them into a short movement striker trigger, and they had problems with it because of the training. So you look at these, and again, this is all historical development and how can we do things better. And you can sit there and go, well, gee, these light, not a lot of movement triggers are really good to shoot better. They're what I call shooting triggers. I mean, they're a way to shoot well, and they become easier to shoot than a double action revolver, for example. However, being easier to shoot sometimes is not a good thing. I just watched what I am, in my opinion, was a negligent discharge by a police officer recently. As soon as he grabbed the person, which happens a lot, with a finger on the trigger, the gun went off.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the claiming it's not an ND, it's an ND. I've watched plenty of video, bunches of these, seen it in person. And you know, but everybody tells me, well, we are, you know, my finger's my safety. I would never put my finger on the trigger. And you know, whether I'm just looking at pictures from the last couple of days of what went on in the Senate without passing any judgment one way or another, of simply seeing photographs of a lot of people with fingers and triggers.
Well, and there's been research and there's so much research that's been done as far as whether or not people are trigger checking. And I'm sorry to interrupt. We actually have to go to break, though, and I'd like to get into this more. And I'd actually like to talk about weird carryovers from historical context that maybe people have missed. But we'll do that in a second. Right now we're talking with Daryl Bulkey. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Centurion Arms, hard-use rifles and accessories at easy day prices. Visit them online at centurionarms.com. This segment brought to you by BigTexOutdoors.com. BigTexOutdoors.com is the best place for you to find all of your everyday carry needs at the absolute best prices. Maybe you need all the Candela from ModLite at the lowest price? No problem. Spend too much time alone in your room and, well, now you need an optic on your pistol? BigTexOutdoors.com has those and they don't judge. Glock accessories? Yes. Fast, cheap shipping, 100% hassle-free returns, all that and more. And best of all, BigTexOutdoors.com has Ike. He's a good man and thorough. I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike, and you'll like Ike, too. Visit BigTexOutdoors.com today and find out what happens when every customer is a friend, not just an order. So we're talking with Daryl Bulkey about history and context and how people get to where they're getting. And I wanted to bring this up last segment when you were discussing the transition from essentially a horse-based mode of travel to a vehicle-based mode of travel and how that affects things. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that, you know, the 1911, which is something that many people are familiar with, was not originally designed with a grip safety. And one of the reasons why a grip safety was added was essentially it was requested so that if people were reholstering on a horse, they didn't cook around through the top of their horse when they were reholstering, right?
So, yeah, and you know what's funny? So on my book, I just did the chapter on a Northwest Mounted Police, which became later the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Colt New Service. And those guns were, I mean, they were really sort of the first real good double action revolvers, and they were literally made for horse usage because they were fairly safe to use on a horse. Unlike the single actions where once you cock that thing, you know, uncocking it is usually done by shooting it. But if you didn't fire, trying to deal with that gun while managing a horse in a combative environment is not a fun thing. You know, single actions work good on a horse if you shoot them. But what do you do if you don't? Well, those big revolvers, and that was a big competition, was for the Army contract between Colt with the new service and Smith & Wesson with the new Century, which is the triple lock. And, you know, the military ended up going with the Colt, with our military, and what they really wanted, they went with the Colt first, but the goal was to get to the 1911 because they really liked the idea of the semi-auto. And that's when, again, some modifications start getting made to get that 1911 ready to be used in a cavalry environment, because we were still very much a horse-based military for moving people at speed in a combative world. And then, you know, like I said, researching, half the fun of writing this book is researching. I mean, researching what the life of was of being a Royal Northwest Mounted Police cop in the early part of the 19th century in the Northwest Territories of Canada. You know, you want to talk about a pretty harsh living environment and working generally fairly by yourself. And the equipment and how you use that, most of those guns, every one I have ever found that was a user that's not in pristine shape, every true user Northwest Mounted Police gun I have ever found has the bottom corner of the grip panel is cracked off. And that is basically from whopping people in the head with the things. Huh. That's, it was an impact weapon. You know, basically is, you know, you're holding a hunk of steel in your hand, and a lot of times those guns were used to convince people they were also a less lethal firearm. But, you know, the things are pigs. They're huge. And, yeah, you know, they are all steel, and you can crack a melon with one of those pretty good. And so you sit here and look at context. We're having actually, for example, used a Glock striking a felon. I was much more successful with that using an end-frame Smith & Wesson than a polymer frame gun. You know, so again, this gets back to the context of how these things are used based on what they are. And some stuff doesn't. Now, the thing is hitting crooks with guns is nothing new, and it will never really go away. But you know, technology has changed the effectiveness or how it's done. And, you know, that becomes sort of, you know, again, we look at this stuff as how does this stuff get affected and how do we figure things out with it? So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, development. You know, one of the benefits, and I'm not a big kind of huge weapon-mounted light guy for everything. I have what I call my offensive guns where I'm taking a pistol to a fight I really should have a long gun in. Most of those I'll have equipped with a light system on them. Most of my stuff doesn't that I'm using for straight defensive purposes. But one of the big benefits to those is it helps. It works also as a standoff device for having the gun function when in contact.
Right.
And again, you know, this is nothing new. It just happens. Do we want to shoot a firearm in contact with our opponent? Not really. Does it happen all the time? Yep.
You know,
so again, you know, it to me is a better solution than, you know, back in the days, and I'm sure you've seen some of the guns with the, you know,
the meat tenderizers,
meat tenders up in front and some of this other stuff. You know, it was people trying to find solutions for stuff that sort of failed. But it failed because, well, you know, or you could put a light on it out there and that works. You know, any gun big enough that you've got this giant meat tenderizer out in front, well, that's the kind of gun I would put a light on also.
Yeah.
So, you know, I could just put the light on and save this other, you know, thing that's on it.
Well, and it seems like, too, that because I understand, I can imagine it now, right? There are going to be people that are listening to this that are thinking, you know, that you're saying something or you know, it's like, well, that's an ideal situation. And it's not so much that you are, sorry, I'm getting distracted there. It's not so much that you're saying, yeah, I want to go out and try and do this. Just sometimes stuff happens. Not the way we would like for it to go.
You know, I had a young man who I've been mentoring for several years, several of us have, who's a young police officer just involved in his first shooting the other night, and called me. Yeah, that's how I spent New Year's, is driving to another state in a snowstorm to be with him. And, you know, first thing I get there, I go, wasn't like any training drill you've ever done. Wasn't like you ever imagined. Wasn't. Nope. Horribly, horribly complex problem solving issues, things you never thought about, things that went against everything everybody who's never done it told you is normal, was all of a sudden became normal. And I go, you know, this is all mostly problem solving and very little about the actual shooting. And, you know, if people would kind of wrap, and you can't convince anybody of this until they've been through it. And that's where sort of some of the experience stuff comes in. And that's why a lot of us kind of are older guys who, especially if we've been in a couple of shootings, you know, we sit there and we nod our heads when, you know, when some 23-year-old's trying to explain to me the way of the world on shooting, because there was a time I was the 23-year-old competitive shooter who was talking out of school to older guys. And, you know, you sit there and go, hey, you know, it's, you know, that's not cool. You know, you go, you all of a sudden you find out that, well, that didn't go, you start getting into this and you go, well, a lot of this stuff is not remotely like what the theory is behind it. And it takes time, and that's part of the big development with this stuff, is getting from what I call theory-based to reality-based. We have a metric ton of theory-based stuff out there, and we don't have a ton of experienced based reality proof in any kind of numbers that are beyond anomalies. So a lot of this historical development comes from all of this theory based good, you know, the good idea fairylands. Well, is trying to see if that really works out takes time. And, it you know, it's funny. I read a lot of these old texts now from the 20s and 30s and, way, you know, 40s and stuff. And you read some of this stuff in depth, and it's like one of the guns I have is from a guy named Bob Nichols, and it was the only Smith & Wesson Fitz ever done. Bob Nichols was the editor of Field & Stream magazine, like in the 30s and 40s, which was like the premier gun magazine in that era. And he has a book, he has Secrets of the Double Action Revolver. You read this, and it is literally, you're like reading, it could have been written yesterday, of the pissing, moaning, arguing,
yep.
My way is better than your way, or this guy is advocating this, and they're an idiot, and they don't really understand it. You know, I'm reading this going, boy, nothing, not a thing has changed. But it turns out that Bob and sort of the people that he was associated in his circle were right, and the other people were wrong. But the other people, it was the more popular opinion, and that was based on the idea that you cock the revolver to shoot and that you can't see your sights in a fight, and you only use double action unsighted.
Yeah.
We trashed police training. We set that back over 70 years.
Yep.
With that theory, you know, would you, and you know, again, and sites are like another thing. I mean, I'll just go down this road. If
well,
you want to
well,
talk about development of technology.
I do, but hold that thought because we have to go to the,
okay.
we have to go to the break and then we'll go there. So right now we're talking with Daryl Bulkey. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Centurion Arms, hard-use rifles and accessories at easy-day prices. Visit them online at centurionarms.com. This segment also brought to you by Centurion Arms. Even if you're just a cook, a lowly, lowly cook, or you call in tactical nukes from your couch every night with ease, you need to know that your life-saving equipment is going to work, and Centurion Arms knows it too. Veteran-owned and operated Centurion Arms is dedicated to producing firearms parts and accessories with an outstanding level of quality, functionality, and precision at prices you can afford. Whether you just need a new rail or barrel or something else to finish off your latest build, or maybe you want to take all the guesswork out and buy a complete rifle, Centurion Arms has got what you need and knows that when you need it to work. Visit CenturionArms.com today to check out all their awesome products. Centurion Arms, hard-use rifles and accessories at easy day prices. So we're talking with Daryl Bulkey about a ton of stuff that I nerd out about. And you were going to discuss sites and development, and let's go from there.
Okay. Well, first I'm going to say, and I've been using Centurion rifles since Monty started. So I'm going to help plug that.
I appreciate
my
that.
My go-to ARs are also Monty's built for me. So, okay, beyond that. So sights. So you look at where we've gone with sights. You know, the idea of using sights and how to use them is not new. I mean, they've been around since kind of we first developed firearms.
Yeah.
You know, and handheld firearms. Most of the advances we have done have all been sight-based, where the idea of, you know, how to use them and the efficiency of them. So I have a King Sights was really a big thing back in the early part of the century,
yep.
King Sight Company. If you look at Colonel Askins' gun, and Askins killed like the absolute plague, and it didn't matter if it was down on the border, felons or Nazi snipers, you know, he used a 38 special revolver that was fixed on the bottom, you know, trigger guard cut out, the whole thing. But the top end of the gun, it was a 4-inch with a King's super target competitive sight. Well, Colonel Askins was one of the greatest shooters this country has ever produced, as far as bullseye and precision shooting.
Right.
And the sighting system on his combative gun was literally a competition-based system that they understood. That's how you put rounds into small places on human beings. I mean, understood it. Now, that's not how everybody's gun was set up. But one of the King guns I have is from the mid-30s. It's a Detective Special King police gun. And it has night sights on it.
Yep.
It's a U-notch night sight. And you're like, yeah, this ain't new. They knew in the mid-30s, but guys like Askins, that's the kind of guns they carried, where most people were telling people, you can't see sights in your fight. No, you can't, because those early Smith & Wesson long-action K-frame revolvers, you know what you can't see when the hammer's down? You can't see the sights. Right. You have to cock it to see the sights. The piece of gear dictated that. When we look at going forward, even, you look at Jack Weaver and starting to win those leather slap matches up with Cooper up at Big Bear. It wasn't because of the Weaver stance at all. It was the fact that Jack Weaver was using two hands on the gun and bringing it to eye level, because everybody else was either shooting generally 1911s or Colt single actions, which all have crap sights back then. And he was shooting a 6-inch, you know, he's a LA County Sheriff's deputy shooting a 6-inch Model 14 that has fantastic sights. Well, all of a sudden, you know, the next big modifications to the 1911, those first kind of custom, really cool 1911s, what did they do to them? They put Smith & Wesson adjustable revolver sights on them. You know, then we get forward, we start getting into night sights. We started in the 80s when I was kind of getting into this originally, you know, it was all about the dots. You know, SIG using dots, you know, HK's using dots, you know, the hot Euro guns were using dots, you know, on sight. Then we start getting into night sights as being a normal thing. Then we start getting back into colors. And then we got colors and night sights. You know, people started realizing seeing that front sight's a kind of a cool thing. And then you get into the realization that, you know, if we put an electronic, some of the dots get reliable enough that we can run a dot on things, and then we don't really have to worry about aligning anything other than finding that dot. And I was shooting a red dot competitive revolver with like an aim point, you know, 1000 or something on it in 1990.
Right.
Competitively. That was my open class gun for shooting speed steel. And, you know, so everybody's all, well, you know, as a evolving, you know, red dots on guns, and then, you know, you wouldn't understand this. And I'm like, well, I was shooting one in 1990. Were you born yet? You
know? Yeah. Well, like, and it's,
yeah, I'm like, it just wasn't practical for any sort of carry. I couldn't go to work with an Ernie Hill speed rig, you know, with the whole front end cut out of it, but we get there. And, you know, and I'm kind of getting back to the red dots again. I visited it about 10 years ago, did a lot of work with them, kind of left it, and I'm kind of back to messing around again with it. It becomes my thought on the red dots is you have to train more and harder than you do on irons, but the gains are much more.
Well,
are huge if you get it down. But a lot of people think they can just slap a red dot on the gun and that's magic. It's not. Unless you probably start them that way, if we're the only thing they've ever shot from minute one. And we'll get there. You know, I tell people, when we get to the point kind of in law enforcement where you start the academy with a gun that's got a dedicated red dot on it and the slot and the dot doesn't cycle, we're there.
Well,
that's going to be sort of nirvana for that.
And this actually really highlights, I think, what the overall problem is when we get the different, I'm going to say generations, talking to one another, but this is the problem. And the problem is this, is that these ideas come up that the technology does not support yet. And at the time, they're the younger generation, but this idea comes up, it's tried, and it is, you know, rightfully, this doesn't work. We're going to do the thing that works. Technology improves, and the first and only experience certain people have with it is this thing 20 years later where now all of a sudden, like, hey, they're reliable, and we can get them on guns, and they're a small enough size that they kind of work. Why would anyone not think that this is awesome? It's like, well, because before that, They weren't,
because 2 decades ago it was a good idea, but not quite there yet.
Exactly, and
you know,
and well,
and,
but
you know, I look.
Well, I was going to say the. Hold on.
Go ahead.
The flip side of that is that when, you know, we, the younger people, are like talking with someone else and they say something that does not match our world experience, the natural human tendency is to go, ah, you know, it's just an old guy. They don't know what they're talking about. And they stop paying attention to everything else that is being said, which is frankly a mistake. And, you know, if being able to understand historical context and why opinions are held certain ways and be like, well, yeah, that is completely and factually accurate for this individual's basis of experience. And like having that open exchange of like ideas, and then for the flip side, for the older generation to be like, okay, this is my experience with it, but the person I'm talking with, that's not their experience with it because things have changed. That's where the middle ground needs to happen, I think.
Yeah, and what it is I think a lot of, now that I'm one of those older people and I can order off a senior menu, my era of people probably need to be more patient, and younger folks need to be more open to listening to people with experience different from them that is not internet-based, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So the biggest problem you see, for example, is I'll run into people and everybody, well, it's faster. Well, define, because see, faster for everybody loves that timer, because faster is an easy quantitative subjective or objective thing.
Yeah.
Here's the drill, here's the timer, here's what the goal is, and you can put an objective thing. And see, people like me who has worshipped at the altar of speed like anybody else has, particularly when I was younger and shooting competitively, is that becomes everything you know. Well, then you get out there and you start actually getting into gunfights and you go, oh, that thing doesn't really matter in this thing. It becomes a whole conglomeration of stuff, but it's hard to explain to people. And you know, like one of the things I get into now, and some stuff I just walk away, sort of my new bless your heart, or I guess I learned a new one in Oklahoma, you're sure pretty. Is that my new sort of walk away thing is, you know, you go ahead and I'll let you just figure it out yourself. You know, it's not worth arguing with some people. I'm like, you know, you'll figure it out. But the problem is, it's like a lot of stuff when I try to explain to people, they're like, well, you know, you old guys don't shoot revolvers right or hold them right. And I'm like, well, you don't think we tried all of these grips back in those days? We're not retarded. I mean, we get it that, you know, we tried a lot of this stuff. The difference is I could say that, you know, I was qualifying hundreds of officers monthly on that system, running them through low light combative courses, running them through different stuff. And we get to actually see them used in shootings that are well researched and we could really take apart. And I'm like, yeah, we saw a lot of that stuff fail. It might have been more efficient for one little piece of it, but it wasn't better overall. That's where you start getting into theory versus reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing, and I tell guys, I go, you know, you guys are making a lot of the same mistakes we made back then. I go, you know what the problem we had with double action semi-autos were back in the 80s and 90s? We were holding them like we were holding a revolver. They're not revolvers. So I tell the guys now, if you quit holding your revolver like your semi-auto, because it's not a semi-auto, they're different things that need to be ran different. You can kind of get it to work. It isn't like we couldn't get those SIGs, Berettas, and HK double actions to work holding them like a revolver. We could. They work good. But had we changed how we were gripping the guns, it would have worked much better. I mean, one of the most greatest things ever said to me was by an old guy you know, where I really couldn't shoot a Glock worth a heck, and I actually loved the guns. I just couldn't shoot them. And, you know, he looks at me, he says, "Son, that ain't a 1911, and you need to quit holding it like one," because I cut my teeth on a government.
Yeah.
And you sit there and go, boy, that's genius. He changed my grip a little. And I shoot a different grip on just about every semi-auto because they all have things placed differently on the gun. And I kind of look at people now and they just go, well, that gun doesn't work for me for my grip. What can you not get out of a pickup truck or a passenger car? The door latch is in a different place. Can you only get out? I mean, human beings tend to be very adaptable.
Yeah.
You know, these guns are different. You might need to hold it a little different. You can use a foundational grip, but you might need to hold it a little different to function the gun properly. Where, you know, I'm looking at people going, well, it won't hold the slide back on the last shot. You know, it won't engage the slide lock because that gun sucks because it doesn't work with my grip. I go, you know, you could just move your thumb.
Well,
it's like, you know, okay, well, you know, and believe it or not, if you shoot it a while with a grip adapted to that pistol, you'll probably shoot it as efficiently as you used to shoot something else with the grip that was better adapted to that system. But again, it just takes time and sort of experience and a bit of an open mind. But that needs to balance with the open mind is just because it's a good idea on the range doesn't mean it's a good idea. It takes kind of a bit of a process to go from theory to proven reality and sort of being open to my idea didn't work or that, you know, because a lot of people, their egos want to cling to the I'm right and I'm as guilty as anybody. I mean, we're all in that boat. It's just time and exposure will open you up to a lot. I mean, you know, I look hard. Everybody's all, you know, bulky hates competition. I don't. I started out, I was a competitive shooter before I was a cop. That's what I started out doing. And it's like, I don't. I'm just trying to tell you that we found that a lot of it doesn't apply into problem solving, or it's a very small piece of the problem solving where you're basing everything on what works on a match or a drill to reality. There's some crossover, but you got to kind of understand what that is. And, you know, some of it you just got to look and go, yeah, you're going to kind of have to figure that out for yourself. I do look at is that's where all the good technology and what I call is all the good technical shooting stuff comes out of that world. It's up to people in the combatives side of it or the two-way range world to try that stuff with a open mind and really make some good things. But the problem is it's a tough lab to work in. I mean, because you actually have to go out and get into shootings, which is not a fun experience by any standard, to really see what's working or not. And it can't be just one. So you're rolling a lot of dice on how is the technical shooting skills applying in to reality and vice versa? What's failing in reality that we could be pulling out of the technical side and trying to meld that stuff? And it's hard and it takes a lot of calm wisdom to sort of look at that stuff. And that's dying out. And it's why I spent so much time interviewing and spending time with people who had been in a ton of shootings, because those people aren't going to exist anymore. There are not going to be cops out there. You will not find cops anymore who have been in 15 shootings.
Yeah,
you won't find them.
Yeah, it's not allowed. I hate to interrupt, Daryl. I really apologize, but we're at the end of the show. The time is gone, and like we could do this
for 3 hours.
Yeah, right. But so I will definitely have you back on to explore this more. But for right now, if people want to read more of your stuff or find out more about you, where can they do that at?
I have a Facebook page. It's DB's Shooting Adventures, which is a lot of historical stuff. And it's sort of what my wife and I are doing. My wife's also in the training side where as an instructor for Shoot Lay It Girl. So, you know, it's a little bit of everything, but I do cover a lot of the historical gun stuff and kind of deep dive articles that I'll rant on. And that's the best place to find it. And I can tell people I do zero politics on there, or very little. So you can get a freedom from that on the internet right now and just read about kind of cool old gun stuff and history, and where things come from is what I tend to spend most of my time writing about. And then our other Facebook thing is for Hardwired Tactical Shooting. We've been really heavily affected by COVID because of the range we use. So we're not doing a lot right now, but it is a good way to keep up with kind of what we're doing on the teaching side. So again, Hardwired Tactical Shooting and DB Shooting Adventures on Facebook.
Perfect. And I always enjoy every post that you put up, and I learn quite a bit every time that you do. So thank you so much for doing that. Daryl, I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. I really appreciate you taking time out.
I'm going back to sleep.
Well, you get...
Still a graveyard guy.
Yeah.
You
get some rest, brother, and I appreciate it. All right, I'll talk to you soon.
No problem. Have a good one.
All right. Make sure you check out our website, BallisticRadio.com. Like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/BallisticRadio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes if you think we've earned it. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.